Well, welcome to the latest episode on Leadership and Culture in Healthcare. I'm Matthew Wynn, podcast host, and we've got two episodes coming up that is slightly different. They're different because we're talking to two groups who are on the latest cohort doing the Aspiring Chief Executive program. So that's going to be really insightful to hear and understand things from their perspective as people who are aspiring, I hope, but we'll find out, to be chief executives in their next role. So I'm delighted to have Rachel Evans and Sean Fenwick, both of you. Why don't we start with understanding a little bit about you? So, Rachel, why don't you kick off and tell everybody a little bit about you and what you do, etc.?
Hi Matthew, it's really good to be here. So I'm Rachel and I have a joint role as both Chief People Officer and Chief Strategy Officer at Oxley's, which is a mental health and community foundation trust in South East London. And a little bit about me. So I started my career as a lawyer in central government and I've done lots of different roles in the public sector since then, mainly in London, but also spent quite a bit of time in Brussels. And I joined the NHS 9 years ago and I immediately knew that it was where I wanted to spend the rest of my career. And so that's why I'm here.
Fabulous. Okay, Sean.
So in typical Northeast fashion, I've been with my current organisation in one form or another for the last 22 years. I was appointed as a consultant renal physician in 2003, and then I've just gone on to a series of additional roles, such as clinical director, deputy medical director. Clearly, that's a slightly more traditional route for a doctor, but then effectively became the coup, which I've been doing for a decade. And in the last 2 years, I've been the deputy chief executive. So it's a combined acute and community trust, having merged with South Tyneside 5, 6 years ago, but very much an integrated trust serving two reasonably deprived populations.
I love that description of typical for the northeast or the northwest, I would suggest. When I've interviewed people, Bijou up in Northumbria, she'd been at the trust for quite some time, and of course our esteemed national boss, Sir Jim, has been there probably since birth. Yeah, not quite that long, maybe. So that's what you do. Really interesting mix of backgrounds, legal background, CPO, coup, doctor, consultant, now deputy chief exec, which kind of leads into, well, why did you apply to go on the Aspiring Chief Exec course? Sean, let's start with you, because what put you forward to do that?
So I've been doing an office director role for quite some time, probably a longer tenure than most. I think I viewed it very much a bit like my clinical education, which is I'm slightly old-fashioned. An apprenticeship takes your time to find it. I think doctors sometimes find it a little longer to learn how to do strategic thinking and leadership because we train to do here and now decisions. So the length of time it's taken me is the right length of time for me. I took on the deputy chief exec post, which was a 2 year tenure to do a well-led review, largely to answer two questions: one, whether I could do the job, and one, whether I wanted to do the job. And being deputy chief exec certainly confirmed that I think, at least, that I could do the job, and certainly affirmed my view that I want to do it. The aspiring chief exec job, therefore, is a program is just something that will assist both. I think it doesn't get you to the point of being a chief executive. What it does is prepares you so that you stand a much better chance for hitting the ground running and doing an effective job sooner than if you'd gone in a little less prepared.
And we'll come back to some of the things you kind of get up to on the program and how it helps you for whatever comes next. But Rachel, what you did, sim the same motivation or something different?
A bit different actually. So I wasn't really clear whether I wanted to be a chief executive or not actually when I applied for the program. It was one of the things that was a possibility, but I wasn't wedded to it. What I really wanted to do was do so have some really good investment in my development to kind of help me think about what I wanted to do next. And it looked like a really brilliant program, and it is actually, it is a phenomenal program that I've really enjoyed. So I kind of went into it knowing that having this sort of investment in my leadership would be really good for me to help me sort my head out about what I might want to do next. I always come out of these things with a load of kind of motivation and energy and kind of real purpose about what I want to do. But as it turns out, the longer I've been on the course, the clearer I've been. I absolutely do want to do this, but it wasn't how I started.
So help people unpack this mystical world of aspiring chief exec world. So I know a little bit about it. I've been to speak to you all and I've spoke to previous cohorts, but you know, is it, as everybody thinks, a kind of proper sheep dip in? You know, you're doing the Masonic alternative of joining a CEO world and actually you don't do anything and then you're just on a list that you get called on. Is that caricature correct?
I'll start. You never quite know what you go into on these programs. But I would agree with Rachel that it's been phenomenal. I think the first thing that has surprised me is that the recruitment process has managed to bring together a cohort who are very, very different people from very different backgrounds. But because the recruitment has been values and ethics based, we've all been able to gel and form trusting friendships very quickly. And that has been the backbone of this, that we like each other, trust each other, and will absolutely depend on each other for the rest of our careers, I have no doubt. The programme has been very self-reflective. I'm probably one of the older of the group. So at 55, you think you're not going to learn too much new about yourself. I've learned plenty. And it's changed the way I've approached both work and some aspects of home life. The programme itself is facilitated by two magicians, Louisa and Eden, who you get into conversations, you start to feel comfortable and they just take you off left and right and really push you. So it's quite an exhausting program. You think you're just going to go and sit and listen to people talk, but it's, you absolutely have to be in the room, fully engaged, and it really tests self. Doesn't teach you how to be a chief exec. That's not a great surprise for anyone who's been on these things, but it opens up a huge amount of endless strategic possibilities by some of the speakers, certainly some of the endless speakers, things that you go, right, when I get into that job, if I get into one of those jobs, those are things I'm going to need to take into my organisation and embed into our strategic aims.
Yeah, so that, I think, I mean, it's quite a journey, as people say. You know, it's not something you can just kind of dip in and out of. It does require some real kind of wholehearted commitment, because you kind of have to delve really quite deeply into why you've become the leader that you are, and to understand maybe some of the things that might hold you back in terms of your leadership, to help you be really clear about what your purpose is, and to maybe the, some of the things that might kind of derail you as part of that. And so that's, you know, that's not easy work, doing all of that kind of self-reflection. But you do it with such a committed group of people. I don't think I've ever been surrounded by people who have been quite so invested in helping each other to kind of become kind of what they're capable of and lifting each other up. So there's something quite magical about that. But there's also, as Sean has said, there's also the fact that we get really stimulated in terms of the people that we get to hear from. So we get to hear from some brilliant chief executives that are out there, but we also get to hear from people outside the NHS, both in terms of the local system, but also kind of outside of the public sector altogether. And I think it really helps you to raise your ambition about what's possible in these sorts of roles and the sort of changes that you can make, and to kind of help you think that it's not just about keeping the show on the road and being able to deal with all of the reactive stuff that's thrown on you in these sorts of roles, but that you can actually have a kind of a real determination that you're going to do something that might make things a bit better for patients and staff at the end of the day. And holding on to that is what's really important, I think, when things get tough. So for me, it's been quite a lot of work on understanding me better, but also making me feel much more ambitious about what these sorts of roles can achieve.
And as I listen to you, both of you reflect on some of the things that you've done, and given that you both started with, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be a chief exec necessarily when I started, it didn't actually be helpful. I suppose the question is slightly more broadly, is this type of program really more essential for all people doing a director role, whether they come from a legal background, whether they come from a medical background, because you're both doing some big, tough jobs as chief operating officer, deputy chief exec, chief people officer. These are all demanding roles. Do you think we're missing a trick on equipping our existing directors, even if they're not going to go on to be an accountable officer or chief executive?
I think it's the observation that is probably the truest, which is things like development, whether it's of your executive team, your managers, your clinical teams, is often the thing that gets lost when life gets busy, when money gets tight. And what this has shown is that you have to protect that development in whatever shape, form it takes, because it will pay dividends going forward. And there are some things that I've taken from this course, some of the things that Rachel's already alluded to, the lifelines and the personal aspects of the opening statements that are relatively straightforward to do from a time and cost perspective. But the things that just don't get done. So certainly the one thing is, what can I do in terms of development in my current role, and certainly in any future chief exec roles? Because what this program has demonstrated is the absolute value of that. You've got to find a balance. How much does it cost? How much time does it take? But development in its broader sense, and this has demonstrated that it's absolutely essential for the NHS to succeed and thrive.
And I guess, and Rachel, you live in this world. We're about to move into a in the UK. So those that are listening in the UK, so the English system will in the NHS will move into a regulatory framework for board roles. And Sean, I guess I'm just there thinking actually to become a consultant, to stay as a consultant, you build into the job plan, you build into that approach, developing people to get to a position, don't you? It's normal stock and veg of doing those things. But Rachel, we don't necessarily do that for our leaders who are coming from a non-clinical background or any other route. They might kind of do some programs, but we don't do that in a standardized way that perhaps the new and future regulatory world might demand of us.
I've certainly come away thinking, because it's had such an impact on me, I've come away thinking, what can we do in our own organisation to try and replicate some of this, to try and create the space to kind of lift our heads up, I suppose, from the real demands of the job and think a bit more strategically sometimes about where we might want to be going, but also about creating space for us all to kind of reflect on who we are as leaders and what it is that we want to achieve. So I think there is a lot to be said for spending a bit more time on those things. I certainly feel like I'm different. I'm better at what I do now. So this isn't all about waiting until you get the big job. This has changed how I approach my role day in, day out now, about the impact that I have, about my kind of passion for what the art of the possible is. And so I do think that's really important to replicate it. And I think we all feel a sense of responsibility that we don't just absorb all of this fantastic investment and it doesn't go any further. We want to make sure that kind of others around us have those benefits too. But I would say that one of the things that's come through, we've heard from quite a few alumni of the programme, and they've come, and there is something about the fact that I think some of these chief executive roles can be quite lonely. That something about creating a kind of a cohort of people that can support you when some of these things get tough, and they can get tough, particularly in the current climate. So I think there's also something important about the cohort of people that you have through this program that you know absolutely have got your back, and who will support you to kind of do the right thing. And what we hear from a lot of the people who've been on this program before is how much they've drawn on that resource to kind of help them as chief executive. So I think it's important for everyone, but I think it's particularly important for people who are stepping into first-time chief executive roles.
So, if I was to ask you both, kind of, I mean, you touched on a few things, but what are the two or three standout things that you kind of have taken away from the program that have kind of you've sat there and gone, "Ooh, I really need to take that seriously and make sure adopted that in my professional life," or even Sean, I think you talked about in family life as well. What might those be?
So we've touched on some of them, but without repeating, I think the development of the relationships with the cohort is incredibly key. It makes the program a success while we're running through it. It'll make our lives a success much better later. And I feel incredibly lucky with the cohort that I've got. That was my principal worry starting this. If that's 12 people I've never met, different backgrounds, I'm not going to get on with them all. I absolutely do. But actually, you speak to previous cohorts, and they've all got the same relationship. So there's something very special about the way that the program is able to bring different people, different backgrounds, different parts of the country together, and form friendships that sometimes take months and years to develop, and we've done that much quicker. The self-reflection, I'm just having time to do that, often missing. So there's quite a few things about myself, support by 360, and certainly the expert Hogan analysis supported by Francis Stickland has made you realise and understand things. You knew they were there, but they've now become crystallised, and that allows you to, as Rachel says, just do things differently now and certainly for the future. The one thing that struck me a little bit and is in my learning goals is how uncomfortable the wellness session made me, that I hadn't necessarily appreciated, not looking after myself so much, but the way that I work and the impact that it has on other people, setting expectations that I didn't mean to set, but because I'm working at certain hours, weekends, etc., that it places an unhealthy expectation on my team. So certainly that's where I've seen some of the biggest changes, which is to just leave them in peace when they're having downtime.
And I've had these conversations with people before. It's not that I'm against this, but people who put on their emails, I choose to work at all out in basically all hours, and I can send it, but you don't need to. And the impact of authority and working in a team isn't that simple, is it? Because actually you're going to impact on them whether you like it or not.
I will have also obviously need to get my act completely together by the time this goes out, so they don't come and tell me that I haven't managed to do that.
Yeah, note to self. Yeah, okay. And Rachel, you what other things have struck you that have, because you said I think you've done things that you've been able to incorporate into your current role and make you more effective.
Yeah, so I think probably the thing that has always held me back has been a lack of self-belief. So there's always been quite a kind of negative self-critical voice, giving a bit of a running critical commentary about what I've been up to. And even though that hasn't stopped me from doing lots of good things, things that I'm proud of, I would probably say that it has held me back, because I don't think that if something goes wrong, I used to really quite kind of pile on the criticism. I would sometimes worry about kind of treading on other people's toes or kind of cutting across people who are experts. And all of those things kind of made me second guess myself quite a lot. And what this process has done is somehow magically has made me take on board feedback I've been given a number of times in my career, which is that I'm doing fine and I just need to get on with it and there's nothing to worry about. But for some reason, I've been able to incorporate that at a kind of different level. And there feels as though there's been a real weight has been lifted. And I feel as though I'm able to be a leader who really enjoys what I do, who's able to contribute across a much wider kind of portfolio than perhaps I would have done previously, and is able to make quite a difference. And it's a really lovely feeling, and it's really nice to have that critical voice kind of becoming much, much, much quieter, and to just be able to, and it doesn't stop me from being humble or knowing that there are things that I can do better, but it just feels as though I'm not weighed down by that criticism. So that's been a real kind of bit of a breakthrough for me, really. And the other thing is just that sense of opportunity. So we've had talks about digital, about what we do about health inequalities, how we might work across the system. And it's really kind of stimulated me, given me a real fire in my belly, really, about what the art of the possible is. So again, you know, I've got a chief people officer and a chief strategy officer role, and just that opportunity to get involved across a much wider array of things and to try and make a difference. That's been really enjoyable, Matthew.
You don't need to answer this if you want to wait for your appraisal for this, but have your colleagues noticed a difference in you since you've been doing the course, either of you?
Definitely. Absolutely. I got feedback at the end of our May board that I was contributing in quite a different way, told me to keep it up. People liked it.
So I've had some comments, but I'm going to actively seek out comments from people who haven't made comments as part of my closing statement, because I want to see whether that's been more widely noticed. I did jokingly say to Eden that if my wife felt I was having an affair because I've changed after being married for 28 years, he would have to explain that it's the programme that's done that and nothing else.
How did that conversation go?
My wife's very comfortable. I have neither the time and the interest to have another person. It's practice.
And I think that's an interesting point. It's not that we're going to talk about affairs. That's given when we're recording this, that's very topical given Coldplay's filming of an affair live. But it's the whole point of spending time doing this is actually it does make a difference, and it's not something that you wait to make a difference. Because there's that kind of thing about I am an aspiring chief exec, so I will wait until I get there. But I think I'm hearing that the impact is on the here and now and in how you do your role.
I don't think I've come across anyone on the course who is somehow storing all of this up for when they're a chief executive. I think the people in that room have got so much kind of determination and passion for making a difference for patients that, you know, you can see it. People are changing right now, and the feedback that we get, and you can see it happening. It's quite remarkable over the time. You know, we've only been doing this properly since February. Is that fair, Sean? The change in people, and yeah, it's really fantastic to see.
Yeah, I would agree. There is noticeable change, and I don't think that is just getting to know people better. There's been demonstrable change. I think that the flip side is that there will inevitably perhaps be some frustration that falls out of this, which is the things that are currently out of your grasp in your current role that you want to get into and do things differently. Which is not to say that we can't have significant influence in our current roles; they're big roles. But I think it is just that spur to how much more you can do if you get in as a system strategic leader than you can do sometimes in the business of the day jobs that we're doing currently. I think the other thing to say that's really powerful is it is about leadership. The thing that struck me fairly early on is just how agnostic everybody is. You would not be able to say who was a finance officer versus a people officer versus an ops person. And I found that really surprising, but also powerful.
So let's carry on with where you were going just then, Sean. Is you were saying the motivation and the opportunity to go into the next role, the next systems role, you described it. So what, as you're sitting here now talking to me, what are your aspirations? What are you thinking now you've done this?
So clearly, I think what it's taught is about fit and choosing the job. So rather than just applying for any job, I think you've got to go to a job, certainly your first job, in an organisation where there is a degree of fit, where you can work in a functional relationship with the chair and the board. That relationship being very key, that's come through loud and clear. Though we've had a number of presentations from both chief execs and chairs, which shows that like relationship can be very, very different. It just needs to be functional. There's the day job and the mechanics of delivering the money, delivering the performance, etc. That's going to be the same in any job. But you need to look for a job where you can make a real difference to the wider issues. So, for example, in the Northeast, not that we're alone, the health inequalities in the neighbourhood work, I think, is the most exciting stuff for the next year to 3 years to get things moving, because that's the thing that's going to make a big difference. The digital agenda, as Rachel's touched on, no way can I realise all of the things that I want to do following some of the digital presentations, nor do I understand all of them, if I'm completely honest. But I think that just opens up an ambition to say we need to push on this harder and faster. And as a chief exec, that will need to be a clear message to both the internal team and the external team, which is let's accept some of the risks because the benefits are endless.
Rachel?
In terms of kind of what next, I'd be lying if I didn't say that if I didn't admit that I kind of check NHS jobs fairly regularly to see what might be coming up. But I don't think I've got a specific kind of role particularly in mind. What I really want is a big chunky leadership job where I feel like I can make a difference and where my passion and my values and things could make a difference. And I think there's a range of different settings where that could be the case. So, you know, as Sean says, so much of that trying to work out if you would be a good fit in that organisation with a chair and what their challenges are, sort of leader that you are, and whether it's what they're looking for. I think that's all, you know, that's all the homework that you do beforehand. I think one of the things that we reflect on quite a lot as a group, though, is this concept of whether it's a CEO role that's suitable for a first-time chief executive or not, and what that means in practice, because there seems to be a degree of expectation that certain roles wouldn't be suitable for people who are new to these roles. And I'm not sure if I completely agree. I think they're all big leadership challenges. So I think that's just an interesting one to explore.
And are you both thinking you want to move to become a chief executive? Interestingly, Rachel, you said a big, interesting job. You didn't say a big, interesting chief exec job or an accountable officer job. So does that mean you're potentially open to something that stretches you in leadership, but it's not necessarily something with that title?
I think particularly with group models and things, there are a range of different sort of kind of leadership roles that are out there. So yes, no, I'm not going to only go for something if it's got a CEO role, if I think it would be brilliant, if I could make a big impact and there'd be lots of opportunities in it.
And I think that's what the programme's given, in that if you asked me before the programme, I'd have absolutely said the only thing I'm prepared to consider is an acute trust as a chief executive. But it's opened my eyes to a wide range of, as Rachel says, the leadership challenge is probably the interesting thing about the next step, not the job title itself.
Yeah. And I think that's really crucial, isn't it? Because the skills one might need in different types of organisations and the leadership that aligns to that will not be dissimilar. It's about adapting that to that particular area. I mean, I remember having a conversation with one of my consultants when I first started being a chief exec, and they said, you know, it was almost grilling me a secondary interview after I'd been appointed. You know, I think you can only do those with medics, to be honest. It was almost, you know, how are you good enough to know my job? And they looked really shocked when I said, I'm not good enough to do your job because I have no idea about your job. That's why I employ you. I'm here to be a leader and to help you to do your job. And it was like, whoo, okay. But that's the truth. It's about bringing all those things together, isn't it?
And creating and creating the conditions for success as well, isn't it? So I think one of the things I've taken away is it's not about having all the answers. It's about framing the right questions and creating the kind of opportunities where people can come together and find those solutions, which is quite a relief because I didn't have all the answers. So I was quite pleased to discover that.
And you touched on earlier about development opportunities. I certainly think clinicians, and I'm really talking specifically about consultants, they learn to do leadership within their clinical team. And some of the challenges that these jobs and what we need even from our clinical team are just wider. I don't think we invest enough time in making them equipped to do the things that are beyond their role within their clinical team.
So I'm going to talk, because as we record this, we're a couple of weeks since the governments in England, the NHS plan, and it sets out, you know, some fairly fundamental ways of the public receiving care from the NHS, or and even the accessing the care from the NHS. But before we do that, and what your kind of views about your leadership role within there, can we just touch on culture? So we've talked a lot about leadership skills, but actually, one of the leadership skills is about creating the culture that allows people to flourish, that allows people to be safe at work and to maximize things. Tell me a little bit about what you've been kind of been thinking about on the course and how you've put that into practice in you being a catalyst to shape the culture in your organizations. I imagine, Rachel, you must think about this a lot, given you're a chief people officer. If you don't, I think we're in trouble, aren't we?
Think we would be in trouble. And it is something I've given a lot of thought to. Probably the thing that formed me most was to realise the impact it had on me in previous roles when I didn't feel like I fitted in or I didn't feel as though I belonged. And it stopped me from kind of raising quite a lot of issues of concern that I had about what was, this is outside the NHS, just to kind of reassure you all. But, I didn't feel comfortable there or accepted. And as such, I found it really hard to raise issues of concern. And it worries me as a leader if people feel like that in any of the organisations that I'm in, because I know how important it is that people do talk about the stuff that's not working, the really serious stuff, but also the things that can just make us better or deliver better care or do things more efficiently and save money. All of those things, you need a culture where people are able to talk up about stuff. So I really believe that listening is a bit of a superpower. I think all of the answers are out there. We've just got to take the time to kind of listen to them and kind of allow them to come forward. So some of the things that we've been doing in my organisation is that I've been leading on is we've introduced a shadow executive, which puts our executive decision making through its paces. And it really kind of helps us to challenge groupthink, as well as giving some brilliant development opportunities to the staff who are on that shadow executive. And that changes yearly. And quite a lot of other organisations have adopted this model as well. And it's going really well. So I love seeing these little shadow executive babies kind of growing up across other trusts, which is fantastic. We have lots of kind of listening sessions to discuss hot topics, where the leadership just listen to people's views and don't kind of, not because they can come up with some sort of a magic wand to fix anything, but just to hear where people are. And that's really appreciated and really helps us to shape what we do. And we put kind of listening at the heart of our values. So our values are we're kind, we're fair, we listen and we care. And just that thing of listening, how we design things, we kind of use experience-based co-design to redesign our policies so that people who've gone through things design the processes. And bit by bit, every time we have stopped and really listened to people's experiences and developed our processes based on that, things have absolutely rocketed and improved. So in all of the areas, we've got some really, really good staff survey results. In all of those areas, all of the credit is to brilliant ideas that came up from the organisation. It wasn't because the leadership went into a room and came up with something brilliant. Every single one was from listening to people in that organisation, and it's made a real difference.
I think if you're not focusing on culture for a fairly large chunk of your job, you're not going to succeed as a chief exec for all the reasons Rachel's just said. And there are some things that you just need to ensure that you do as well as say, because that's not always the case. Listening to one of your podcasts with Bijou, it's about doing what you say you're going to do, because people see that and it changes the next time. Some of the things Rachel's touched on, which is, do you genuinely have an open culture? Are you prepared as an executive team to listen to some hard truths? Because I'm not sure where everybody is. Sometimes you've got to go and hear some really difficult stuff in order to step forward. But if that's, I can't say that, they'll take that as criticism. So that open culture, we know that civility saves lives. Something as simple as just addressing poor behaviour at all levels, whether that's a recurrent behaviour or just a bad day at the office. But there are some things around culture. You're not going to get a uniform culture across an organisation. There's too many pockets. Theatres is never going to be the same as outpatients, and et cetera. But some of the underpinning elements, which is you will all be civil, we will listen when you say things, and we will try and improve things that are not there. You've done podcasts on the staff survey, and if we use that correctly to drive improvement, then we'll get significant improvements. If we just look at the scores to go, oh, we need that one to be a bit better, then you've got an action plan that will never deliver the cultural change that is required.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's interesting, I think in series one of podcast, the last one with Michael West, he talked about some of the indicators now that they're absolutely looking at that is a predetermination, frankly, of the productivity and the care that is provided straight from the staff survey results. And again, that point of how do we use that data rather than keep on asking our staff the same thing? We'll actually use the staff and then be inquisitive about actually what people say. And I think your point is right, Rachel, isn't it? If you go and listen, our staff are going to tell you in my experience every single time why they can't do the things that you might want them to do. And often they're in your gift of change.
Yeah. And often if you keep asking them and you don't change it, at some point they're going to stop telling you.
Of course they are. So all excited, somewhat equipped, ready for the next adventure. And we should then put a rider not immediately wanting to leave their jobs because they love it, which we should probably say about both of you, of course. But 10-year plans out, some really radical stuff in there about can we do care differently? Can we use digital? Can we use data? Can we lead in a different way? What are the couple of things that, let's try and fuse two things together, the ambition of the 10-year NHS plan and your ambitions to be onto a new role in the future at some point when the right role comes along? What are you thinking what in that kind of fusing of those two things together, what's kind of sitting there and making you excited and thinking, there's the opportunity? I think I probably know what it's going to be, but go on, let's see where we can go.
So one of the things I'm really excited about is the end of the kind of paralysis. So it feels as though we've been waiting for the 10-year plan for quite a long time. It feels as though there have been quite a lot of things that have caused people to be, I don't know, just waiting for something. So I'm really excited about the fact we can crack on with it now. There's nothing in there that I don't think is eminently sensible. We've got now the opportunity to really seize it. I've had a few light bulb moments about the digital side of things, not just the kind of ambient scribe things that can save quite a lot of time for clinicians and give them more time to focus on care, but thinking about our CAMHS services, for example. What would a digital first model look like for complete whole new generation that could be really focused on people's experiences and could give them access to things straight away that could make a difference? To me, when I'm seeing kind of our waiting lists and demand for those sorts of services going through the roof, it really kind of gives me, you know, a real drive that we could be thinking about doing something dramatically different. But I'm just really liking the fact that that period of waiting is over and we can get on with doing the right thing and making the changes that we want to see.
Are you sure?
I agree. I think that the 10-year plan sets a really exciting opportunity, and it's for us in the NHS to take that and run with it. We're not going to be given a Haynes manual how to do it. We're going to have to go make that work locally within our systems. And so certainly my current job, but in a chief exec job, getting in at ground level now is really exciting because you can change the way that the NHS delivers care with the framework that's being provided. Clearly, if we don't make those necessary changes, the NHS will perhaps get a bit more directive and we'll lose the opportunity to really do what the intent is, which is to make services for the population that you serve. If I reference my clinical background, when I was a shiny new consultant quite some time ago now, there was a very clear primary care population, a very clear secondary care population. Lots of patients sit in the middle, and we need a clinical and operational plan that delivers the care that they need. And then we worry about how the mechanics of contracts, etc., will deliver that. We need to get very quickly beyond what contracts say, what people have traditionally done. And that in itself is quite a large cultural piece, because I think primary care and secondary care in terms of relationships are probably a bit further apart than they were 20 years ago, because we keep doing things to each other that creates work for each other to protect ourselves.
Yeah, and I think therein lies the rub, isn't it? That it's about relationships and trust, isn't it? That we understand you. But I think the risk therein is, I think, the NHS England exec are quite rightly asking organisations to take responsibilities, manage your world well, do it well, don't blame others, you know, look to your own elements. And I think we've got to just be mindful, and part of leadership is making sure, yes, we do that, but we do that with everybody else in mind, of which I think your point, Sean, about primary care is absolutely right. We can't do it at the risk of one or other parts of our workforce having a harder time as a consequence. Life's not like that, is it?
Yeah, but I think if you look at the leadership at the top in the Secretary of State and Jim, they're looking at the regulation, the things that get in the way. Jim, as ever, is very clear about getting on and doing things and not waiting for detailed permission. So we have an opportunity in the NHS, I think, to take with this and run with it. But if we're not making the progress that we need, then clearly people like the Secretary of State haven't got forever to wait. I mean, he's got a manifesto to deliver. I think he's given us a framework where we can give him what he needs politically in the very best way that gives us good clinical outcomes. So the 10-year plan for me is exciting. Is that I think it gives us a new way to deliver healthcare that isn't all hospital-based, gives people what they need. But the NHS has to grasp that. And by the NHS, I mean, and not just the NHS, clearly our social care partners, the voluntary sector, we need to come together and do grown-up things that isn't about our own sovereignty and our own parochial requirements.
And then as a final reflection, what would you say to people you are thinking of going on this course that you've just done, this development opportunity in the future, what, again, I think I know what you're going to say, but what would you encourage them to do and to think about before they get going down the route? Rachel?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that the course rightly puts a lot of focus on is around your sense of purpose, you know, why you're here, some of the things around equalities and really recognising about kind of anti-racism and anti-discrimination and thinking about the part that you play in that, caring about the kind of health inequalities that are out there, having a willingness to be vulnerable. You know, you can't keep all of your armour on in this course. You've got to be really willing. I think someone said to me when I did my assessment centre and said to the whole group, it's a little bit like emotionally vomiting on the table, which is not the most beautiful imagery, but it's, as you can imagine, one that's really stuck with me. But there's that kind of sense that you do have to be willing to kind of explore some things that might not always feel comfortable with a group of people you don't know that very well in the beginning. So I think I would say it is the best thing that you could possibly do, but you have to completely commit to kind of immersing yourself in it. But you might want to think now about the role that you play in relation to things like inequalities and your values-based leadership and the sort of difference that you make.
Yeah, any thoughts, Sean?
Could not recommend the programme any higher. If I've got one comment on the negative, our program's been a little more compressed and it's felt a bit rushed, you've just tried to get too much done too quickly, and some of this benefits from a bit of time, but I entirely accept the drivers behind that and the people sitting behind it, both our praxis facilitators and the chief exec or chair that support that have made the greatest value from that. It is a lot of work. It needs to be balanced with the day job. So your gaffer needs to understand that as well as yourself. But it is a program I'd absolutely recommend, though clearly I wouldn't recommend it in the next 12 months or so till we've got our job sorted. We don't want to plug the market. But I think I would just want to give a huge thank you to the number of people who've got very busy day jobs, who've invested their time very generously, and really made the programme what it is.
So it sounds like it was worth being emotionally naked at the same time as vomiting whilst you got reclothed and equipped to do your jobs to take your own themes. I feel a bit queasy even saying that altogether, but it sounded you've had a highly productive time, even though you would probably like a little bit more. So look, both, it's been fascinating to listen to you. You've clearly, you know, come from very different backgrounds. Sean, you're a lifer in the NHS, grown up in learning to be a doctor. A lifer, that sounds terrible. That sounds like you've done something wrong, doesn't it? I take that back. A long-termer NHS person and Rachel, relatively new, but both going on the course because you wanted to be inquisitive. I thought what was fabulous was listening about how you had to engage all the way through, the self-reflective nature of what you need to do. And that thing about, which frankly all good leadership is about teaching you to be effective about yourself, understanding yourself so you could be. And I think you were both very clear about being a great leader. And yep, that leader might take you to be a chief executive, that leader, but it has equipped you to make sure you can do that, to listen well, to focus on the future, to get into the tough things. And I think, as always happens with these, is to get a really great set of colleagues in your cohort who can, I think, support you through the rest of your career, whatever that takes you, because your colleagues were right and some of your speakers are right. These roles can be quite lonely. You know, the accountable officer has to be the accountable officer and take things on the shoulders that others don't. But if you've got 10, 12 people around you who you know you can call on, that's a pretty good outcome, isn't it? A pretty good gift. Sean, Rachel, thank you for being so very fabulous and open about your leadership journey. We wish you well. I'm sure all of your colleagues hope that you won't be moving on very rapidly and you will continue to be fabulous in your jobs. But I'm sure, given what investment you've made and your ambitions, we'll be seeing you in a different type of leadership role in the future. And thank you for joining me on Leadership and Culture in Healthcare. It's been a delight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.